Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions and your emails, both phone calls and emails, and all here for the next hour. So, before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I wanted to start with a couple of drug alerts that have come across my desk, and I think it's important to emphasize that every year, over 100,000 people in the United States die by accident from drugs that were properly given according to instructions for appropriate indications, but something goes wrong. Now, often what goes wrong is just a bad combination of individual physiology and impacting with the pharmaceutical, but also, well, the devil's in the details when you start combining things. And a recent paper that was presented, a case control study, which means that it is not a placebo trial, but they did their best to compare, published in the October 30th British Medical Journal. The report looks at combining two very common drugs, cotrimazole, which is sometimes called Bactrim. It's a combination of sulfamethoxazole and trimethoprim, two common antibiotics. This is used all the time for prostatitis, bladder infections, sometimes now skin infections in the wake of MRSA, and ARBs and ACEIs. These are ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers, two extremely commonplace antihypertensives. Well, it turns out when you combine the two, a subset of the population gets elevated potassium, and this hyperkalemia sets people up for fatal arrhythmias. The rate of sudden death was 30% higher in people taking this combination. That's a pretty substantial increase, and it doesn't take long for this to happen. About 3 days of antibiotic is enough for the elevated potassium to occur. Now, this study comes out of Canada, so where they were able to track things like that because they have a centrally organized database as opposed to the individual silos. That rugged individualism and competitive spirit of America, you know, sometimes it bites you on the behind, and in terms of medical and science statistics, it certainly is the case. The other interaction that I want to bring to your attention is one with these new anticoagulant drugs. We used to use Coumadin, affectionately known as rat poison, to thin the blood of people with atrial fibrillation or thromboembolisms. And now we have a whole new class of, guess what, expensive drugs being widely promoted to doctors. These drugs are factor 10A inhibitors, and they're good drugs in that you don't need to keep getting blood tests. They have a reasonable therapeutic window. Oh, sure, they cause GI bleeding just as much as, or maybe a little bit more than Coumadin. That's still being argued. So they're certainly no safer. Oh, but here's a big deal. These drugs interact with a wide number of psychoactive medications and anti-seizure drugs. I really want to emphasize to people who have epilepsy or are on anti-seizure drugs or are taking centrally acting agents, particularly a lot of elders are taking small doses of atypical antipsychotics. And these drugs are proving to be very beneficial for managing bipolar disease. And we're talking many, many doses. You know, we're not hitting people with a load of Thorazine here. So I think it's legit medically. But if you also throw in one of these factor 10A inhibitors, you can get a lethal problem with bleeding. So for all the medical people who listen, the nurses and the doctors, and I know I have quite a few out there, I was surprised at this interaction, and I haven't seen it really being mentioned very much in the product literature. Surprise, surprise. The big pharma companies aren't telling us about a major interaction. I'm sure it's hidden somewhere down there in the fine print, but it really needs to be in bold type. So, folks, coming to you soon, a black box warning, but only after some fatalities. So if you are placed on one of these drugs, have the doctor run an interaction check. Make sure, if you are a doctor or a nurse, that interaction check happens. This is a big front page story just waiting to happen. And we're going to go to our first caller, and that is Robert in SoCal. Hello, Robert. Welcome to the program.
My topic is anaphylactic shock or anaphylaxis from the radiological chemical stress test.
Yes. Okay.
And I've had one some years ago, and then one, I guess maybe not a year ago.
You mean the stress test, not the anaphylactic reaction, I hope.
Well, that's what I'm calling about.
Okay.
So the first time I was, I was admonished, oh, well, do you have a headache? You feel weak? You feel, no, I'm fine. And I was. The second time, I barely could find my way out of a one-story facility. And I couldn't operate the buttons in the elevator. It was just one floor. And when I got home, my blood pressure was 185, and I really thought I was going to die.
Were you itching?
I don't remember that particularly, but I just remember the symptoms were very much like extremely dehydrated, except I really felt as though I was going into shock.
But you had a high blood pressure, so shock is by definition a low blood pressure.
And then it wasn't. Then maybe it wasn't anaphylactic shock.
No, I don't think so. The symptoms of anaphylactic shock definitely include vascular collapse, low blood pressure, all the blood literally leaks out of your blood vessels. Also often itching, wheezing, swelling in the throat, facial swelling.
No, this was not it.
Yeah, this sounds like a bad reaction, though, some sort of adverse reaction.
Yeah, it was.
Maybe it seems like it affected your central nervous system rather thoroughly. So, clearly a bad reaction. So you need to report this to the doctor and also the facility.
Well, I did, and they didn't give one hoot.
Well, they may have held a poker face, but I think they gave a hoot. Who did you talk to?
Well, I talked to one of the PA, the primary assistant person.
Yeah, do it in writing. Send a letter to the person who runs the facility.
Yeah.
They need to, first of all, they need to check what they gave you and check the batch. And this would represent an adverse drug reaction and should be reported. There is, in fact, a requirement that when people experience an adverse reaction, well, let's put it this way. It is a rule that is honored in its breach, as they say. We're supposed to report these. It mostly doesn't happen. But you do something in writing to an institution. It's amazing. Send a copy off, CC it, and it should be CC'd, by the way, to the FDA. And there is on FDA.gov, you can report this reaction yourself, and you should. It could be an idiosyncratic reaction, but there's millions of people in this country, so probably somebody else had something similar, and it obviously needs to be chased down.
Well,
you've never felt this way before, right?
I am full of idiosyncrasies.
Well, yes, but you're probably not completely unique in this vulnerability.
Yeah, no kidding.
So,
thank you. That's,
please pursue this.
Good advice, and take it. I will heat it.
Thank you very much.
Call.
All right, you have a good day. Bye-bye. So, in general, I just want to say on the subject of adverse drug interactions or reactions, we need to have a better, more transparent reporting system. It would be nice to somehow indemnify doctors and institutions so that they didn't feel that when they reported stuff, they were asking for a malpractice suit. Which is, I think, kind of what goes through people's heads right now. It shouldn't be like that. We really need a no-fault system to compensate people who are injured by medical procedures or medical devices or pharmaceuticals Yeah, you can prosecute people who've done something wrong, but you don't want to make successful prosecution the way that people get compensated when something goes wrong for them. I promised that we would do a little science lesson. This was at the end of last week's show in response to an email from Inez in Spain. And just to recap, Inez's email said, in Spain, there's a great deal of debate about the use of IgG food hypersensitivity tests, and there's a lot of fraud concerning this matter of nutrition, diets, and food intolerances, and I would like to know your opinion on the validity of these tests. If they are really useful, please let me know the minimal amount of foods that should be tested, and if there are any other recommendations or advice I have to keep in mind relating to it. So, Inez, let me just start by saying that when we talk about anaphylaxis, as our previous caller, we're talking about something involving a type of antibody called IgE. IgE is on the surface of a type of immune cell called mast cells. And when an antigen, something you're allergic to, actually touches a couple of the IgGs on the surface of these mast cells, the mast cells unzip their suitcases and release a whole bunch of really dangerous toxic chemicals, which include histamine and various leukotrienes. And when there's a massive release, you get vascular leakage, a drop in blood pressure, the formation of hives, the production of wheezing, and in extreme cases, death. This is what is going on in that a third grader who can't be in the same room with a peanut. His immune system has gotten so hypersensitized to peanuts that he's at risk of one of these anaphylactic reactions and has to carry epinephrine to try and foil it should it occur. This is what a bee sting death is like when a person has anaphylaxis to that bee venom. Now, that's not what we're talking about when we talk about IgG. IgG is another type of antibody. It's the one that you typically make when you are vaccinated against a substance. We use this all the time. We vaccinate people against, well, let's say tetanus. We vaccinate people against measles. And what effectively happens is that you have antibodies circulating and cells that make antibodies circulating that will recognize these things the next time you're exposed to them and coat them with IgG, which is a marker to the immune system. Once things are coated with IgG, the immune system cells come along and eat them up. And that is acquired immunity in a nutshell, or a piece of it anyway. So blood types, a person who has a transfusion reaction from receiving the wrong blood type, that's mediated by IgG. And they can get bone pain, they can get joint pain, they can get a rash. They can feel really terrible, just generalized, but it isn't an anaphylactic reaction. It's a different kind of reaction. Now, we blood type proteins are actually found on the surface of foods. These are common food lectins, and so people become sensitized just naturally to other people's blood types by the virtue of eating. So we've always known that a little bit of food antigens cross the gastrointestinal barrier into the bloodstream and eventually sensitize the immune system to blood types. And so it's considered, quote unquote, normal to have low levels of IgG to food. In functional medicine circles or alternative medicine circles, the concept is that in people with a damaged intestinal tract, they will have higher levels of IgG, sometimes high enough levels that they can get a reaction similar to something we call serum sickness. Back when we used to use horse serum, people would get IgG not just against the tetanus, but also against the horse antibody. And then if they ate horse meat, enough of the horse antibody could get into their system and they could have a reaction, a GI reaction. On the other hand, if they ate horse meat a lot and you gave them horse serum, they could have enough antibody that they would actually react to the horse serum. So we're aware of this phenomenon, and this serum sickness type reaction is possibly far more common than is generally supposed. But when people test for IgG in a blood test, they often think of it like an allergy. Oh, I must absolutely avoid this substance, or I will get very sick. And that's probably not true, and it leads to a lot of misunderstanding, and this is where the controversy arises. I've been using IgG in my medical practice for quite a while, and I look at the antibody levels. If I find that a person has very high levels against, let's say, different milk proteins and dairy products, then I advise them to limit or restrict their use of these dairy products. If I find that a person has a high number of antibodies to a wide variety of foods, I'm worried about their gut integrity. And so, yes, I will tell them to avoid these foods, but my therapeutic emphasis is going to be on finding out why they have a breach in their gut integrity, why they're being exposed to all these common food antigens. Are they having trouble breaking them down? Do they need digestive support? Do they have an ulcer? Do they have celiac at a low level, so a kind of celiac disease that hasn't manifested as true weight loss and diarrhea, so they don't know that they've got an intestinal breach. And that, by the way, is extraordinarily common. And we now know that, you know, the celiac, quote-unquote celiac disease patients are just the tip of an iceberg of a whole lot of people who actually react badly when exposed to gluten. And one of the silent submerged reaction is the breach of the intestinal barrier. Well, how do people manifest? Well, they come into the office and they say, I'm tired. I don't feel good. They sometimes come in sounding like a hypothyroid patient or an anemic patient. But then as a conventional medical doctor checks their labs, the labs are all normal. You tell the person, I think you might be depressed. That's a situation where checking for food sensitivity and maybe discovering that the person does have gut integrity breach and needs treatment for that, as well as avoidance of the substances they've become highly sensitized to. Well, you know, that's a real different way of approaching medicine. And I have to say, in the last 5 years that I've been behaving that way and looking for those things, I found quite a few cases, and we've made a big difference in those people's quality of life by addressing that issue. So I don't think it's bogus. I don't think it's fraud. I don't think it's quackism. But I also think that it's not allergy and that it's a far more nuanced issue than just, oh, I have antibodies to this. I need to avoid it forever. Let's go now to Rick in Carmel. Hello, Rick. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thank you. Thank you for the show and for the archives that are online. Very useful. I'm almost 62 and trying to be an adult about taking care of, you know, medical things, and you know, generally I've been very healthy, and so a couple of things. I went to the doctor and got a whole bunch of blood tests and everything. Most everything was good, but he there's three things I should probably, I don't know which one, I think I should, at first I should talk about a hernia operation because it's scheduled fairly soon, and I just heard you talk about the dangers of
the mesh.
Plastic mesh.
Yes, the mesh.
And I don't know what this, if there are any alternatives, or I should find out what he's using, or if I've had this for about 30 years.
Why are you fixing it now?
Because I have, better insurance, and because it pops out a little bit more than, it's down in the pelvic area, it pops out a little bit more than it used to. Never been terribly painful, but when I, you know, if I, you know, push on in some way. And I went to my doctor and we looked at things and he says, well, you know, you've never had a colonoscopy, okay, get that. And haven't had the hernia operation, okay, better get that. And then the third one he said was, which is, I've also heard some things you talk about, was he said, better get a CT scan, because even though my cholesterol, my mixed number is very low, like 175, he did the apolipoprotein B thing, the size, and it says I'm high, I'm 85. But, you know, no heart disease in my family, and I'm fine and I'm healthy, I'm not overweight, and I eat pretty well. So he says CT scan, you know. So
okay, this is not computing for me, hon. Okay. A CT scan for an elevated cholesterol? Okay, I think what we're talking about is maybe coronary calcium score. So what he wants to do is a spiral CT to look at whether there's calcium in your coronary arteries.
Yeah, but he said it had to, it was because of the apolipoprotein B score. That's why he thought we should see if I'm should get on a statin or something.
Okay, you yes, but
am I confused?
No, you're not confused. It's just a little. I don't know the situation at the office, but you just described a rather non-standard approach. And the first thing I would do is check and see if your doctor has a financial share in a CT scan, or if the people who employ him have a financial share in a CT scan. Because this sounds to me a little bit of a leap, let's just say, in terms of the normal sequence of events. So I'm wondering if it's like, oh, you know, we got a live one here. You know, let's do everything, and yeah. Oh, we just happen to have the CT scanner right here, so we've decided to, you know, start. We're now going to do coronary calcium scores on everybody because we can. You want to be sure, for one thing, that the insurance will actually pay for that, which
It does not pay for that.
Yeah, okay.
That's the one thing. I actually had it done. So it's kind of that's sort of over in a way. I heard about your discussing this, like, the day after. But anyway.
Okay, well, let's kind of tighten up the discussion then to some specific questions. So ask me a question.
Okay. Should I cancel my hernia operation for a while, since there's nothing terrible about it, and wait? As last time you talked about it, that I heard you said, you know, kind of if we could wait and see until the numbers are in, or there's a better possibility, it might be a good idea to just postpone.
Yeah. Okay.
Like,
the other thing you could do is you could see if you could find a surgeon who would just do a hernia repair on you without the mesh. And the reason they stopped doing that was because the failure rate on them was a couple percentage points. So let's call it one in 25 would fail.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would say, well, you know, now that we've got this new mesh, and we are doing this procedure differently using the mesh, our failure rate is down to, you know, 1 in 1,000. So this is a fabulous breakthrough in terms of the number of redos. But if you stop and think about it, if 4% fail, then that means that 96% don't fail. And those are pretty good odds. So you could conceivably have your hernia repair and just don't have the mesh. And you would probably have to shop around and find a surgeon who's willing to do that. I think it's a negotiation, really, in terms of working with the doctor, because you're asking him to do something and it might fail. If it fails, then he's kind of, it's a black mark on his record, even if that's what the patient really wanted. But I think especially if you went out looking at older independent surgeons, you might find somebody who would work with you.
Okay.
You know, the people who have just recently come out of training would probably not even know how to do the procedure without mesh.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of want somebody who was doing surgery 25 years ago. But that's not that hard to find.
Yeah, this is an older guy.
Well, just talk to him. And, you know, it also depends on personality. It depends on whether you're working for yourself or whether you're working for a company. Because if you're an employee, then, you know, you have to work within the principles and structure of the place of business. Medicine is changing. It's being essentially bought out by corporations indirectly and or directly. And, you know, you can argue that that's in some ways a good thing, because it will smoke out bad doctors. And, you know, if somebody's got a substance abuse issue, you can't really hide that as easily in a group setting as you can in a single private practice. So that's certainly a factor. You can make the argument that it standardizes, and if you believe that standardization is always good, then, yeah. All I'm saying is you've got a lot of options, really, although they aren't necessarily being presented to you fully.
Okay.
Okay? Second question.
Great. second question is, after doing the research on your archives, I pretty much decided I will cancel the colonoscopy and get and ask my doctor if he'll just do the fecal test that apparently will detect if there's any colon cancer.
It's if you do it every
as long as I do it every year.
As long as you do it every year, yeah, it's and, just as good as every as a ten, as a colonoscopy every 10 years. That's true at finding cancer. So finding cancer while it's still curable. That's basically how you have to ask the question. The doctors don't get paid very well to do a fecal occult blood test, and the colonoscopy is a major cash cow for the medical industry. Mm-hmm. So you may get some pushback on not doing a colonoscopy, but it's your right not to do one. So mm-hmm. I would encourage you to make up your own mind.
And do doctors do that at their offices, or is it usually a lab thing?
Colonoscopies are
the fecal
blood test. What you want is one of the advanced tests, like a FecaSure, and those are a kit that are sent home with you.
Okay.
And they use an antibody reaction to blood as opposed to a chemical reaction, the old GWIAC test. I still use it, but it is this test is better. So FecaSure is a trade name. That's the one that's typically done locally. That's the one that Quest will give out if you use that lab or your doctor uses that lab.
Okay.
And there's also a new test. It will not be covered by your insurance. It checks for cancer DNA, and I'm really waiting for that one to supersede and really replace colonoscopy. But it needs a track record, and the preliminary stuff looks pretty good, though.
Can I get that now?
Yeah, you can. It's I'll double check during the show, but I believe it's called ColoSure, I think, and I will check and get the actual name. I haven't been using it yet because it's a little expensive. It's like $150 for the test, and mm-hmm. so it's not funded. I haven't had anybody take me up on getting it.
A lot cheaper than a colonoscopy, though, even though they get covered. But
a lot cheaper.
In the big scheme, think of how much money that would save.
Yep. Think of it.
Anyway.
That would require a coordinated system where smart people without vested interests sat down and figured out how to do things right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, your show and all this information, it puts a lot of responsibility, I feel, on we as patients, and so that's it's a little daunting, but I think it's great, and it's the only. If it's the only way to go, really, if these days it seems like you can't, trust but verify, I guess.
Trust but, well, look at it this way. If you were going to buy a car, a new car, let's say, wouldn't you read widely, look at reviews, talk to a few people? Wouldn't you research it a bit, not just plonk down the money on the
the salesman
or the next ad that you see on TV? Oh, that's the car I'm going to buy. Would you do that?
No,
you wouldn't. And yet we're kind of like that with drugs. We're kind of like that with what is offered to us as medical possibilities. And you risk benefit isn't. We need to factor in the risk benefit of everything we do.
Okay.
All righty.
Well, I thank you so much, and we can explore the business of the...
Yeah, and the test, by the way, my producer found it. It's called ColoGuard, ColoGuard.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. I just want to respond to this email from Diane, Diatomaceous Earth. I've talked with someone who takes a teaspoon of diatomaceous earth internally daily and says they feel and look better. I'm looking for a detoxifying or cleansing type supplement. What would my opinion be? Well, I looked up diatomaceous earth, and it's basically silica that's gone through a organism called a diatom and been shaped into a nice little pretty cage-like structure. It is often kind of ground up and taken internally. It is used as a treatment for parasites, and definitely does work. It's used for farm animals for that purpose, and it does kind of scour your insides just mechanically. It isn't absorbed, so I consider it to be safe. Might actually impair the gut integrity a little bit, so could be irritating for people who have something like inflammatory bowel disease or celiac. I don't think I'd suggest it for them, but for people who have pretty good GI functioning, I don't think it's harmless to potentially beneficial. Don't really know how much detoxifying you're going to get with it. I always, basically, if you're looking to detoxify, you really need to help the liver. Good agents to help with liver detoxification would be things like dandelion or a milk thistle, silymarin. That would be a better agent for general detoxification. And also, don't forget onions and leeks and garlic. They contain sulfur, which is just an awesome detoxification assist to your overall system. Let's go to our next caller, and that is Robert. Hello, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hello.
Good morning. Your medical knowledge is invaluable to thousands of people, and we really appreciate your program every morning, every Saturday morning.
Thank you.
Just a quick note, the guy that was just on having hernia problems, I've had two hernia operations, and I started to get another one, and I took two bottles of Hofthornia recommended to me by a friend, and the hernia went away.
That's amazing. I'm not sure I believe you, but that's wild.
Yeah, and I wouldn't just do something because I've got a serious thing, but I've gone through two major hernia operations with mesh, and I was totally blown away when the thing within days started to dissipate, and it is totally gone. Hofthornia. I would tell that gentleman to go online and try Hofthornia. It's very cheap. It's like $20, $25 a bottle. Well worth an investment. Anyway, my issue is on September 5th, I had an upper molar removed, anticipating an implant. And it's 2 months later, and I've gone through three major bouts of antibiotics, and the infection, I can't get rid of the infection. I have a huge infection. It's draining through the hole where the tooth is pulled and down in my throat, and it's very irritating, and they're talking about going to an ENT or an oral surgeon now, the people that pulled my tooth. And I am kind of at my wit's end.
They pulled the tooth because it was infected, though, right?
Well, the tooth was, a crown had come off, and it took an hour and a half to get the tooth out.
Had you had a root canal in that tooth?
No. No.
Okay. All right, so you had an infection. The crown came off.
It started to be painful, so there was a root in it.
Yes, gotcha.
And so they had to split the tooth into three parts and take it out. It was excruciating.
I bet.
The damn tooth out.
I bet. I'm wondering if possibly you've still got some tooth in there.
Well, they've taken X-rays. They've done all they could, and they said, you know, we went through the protocol that we do with every tooth extraction, and I said, you know, he said, well, it's not the first time this has happened. I said, well, you know, I don't care about anybody else.
Well,
I've got infection here.
You should care about everybody else. I mean, I know what you're saying.
You know what I mean.
I know what you're saying. So your question.
I can't get rid of it. It's affecting my voice. It's up in my ear.
Gotcha. Okay, so your question is that
how do I get rid of this?
Well, you're probably going to have it. This is one of those things where when you've got a dead toe, we have to cut it off.
Yep.
You can't really leave it there because it's going to make you sick. It's rotting flesh, and
right.
At this point you've probably got infected bone with a bacteria that's had a chance to, it maybe has some dead meat up there. There could be a tooth with root fragments. So it's basically got raw meat that's in this hole that the immune system, which is, you know, called the bone, and the immune system can't get in there at high enough, it can't get enough troops on the ground to actually kill the infection. So instead, what it does is it cordons it off. Gee, does that sound familiar, like some foreign policy decisions that are being made globally? Anyway, aside from, you know, the Syria issue, this is probably dead infected tissue that has to come out. So you're looking at surgery to scrape out the dead bone, get to the root of the tooth, and you're not going to get an implant in that anytime soon. I mean,
no,
you're going to be missing a tooth. Is it a very back tooth, or is there
it's a second from the back, so, on the upper left, and I figured what I would do is wait a while. I'm 70 years old, and I don't need an implant right away.
So no, you don't. And you may never be able to have an implant there. And
I agree.
But you're going to need an endodontist, an ENT, an oral maxillofacial surgeon. How that divides up tends to be community specific. But, you know, somebody who's able to get in there, essentially cut away, open up the gum and scrape out all of the dead infected tissue, get you down to clean, healthy bone, and then sew the gum back up and let that heal. And, you know, that's months for the new bone to form.
The conundrum to me was when they pulled a tooth on because you've got the sinuses, you know, above those teeth roots, tooth roots, there is a hole there for weeks and weeks until it starts to heal over. It's basically 2 months, and it's just starting to heal over because I was able to blow air, believe it or not, funny, blow air up through that hole and have it push the drainage out into my throat and my nose.
Okay.
It's just been crazy after almost 100 antibiotic pills.
Sure. It's...
And then I went to a holistic dentist over in Sunnyvale who does ozone therapy.
Right.
I had ozone shots. I've had those twice.
Okay.
And I've also done an inhalation, a 20-minute inhalation of ozone.
Well, I wouldn't have. If you'd called me before going there, I would have told you to save your money on those. But in any event, this is like the guy with the gangrene who I had this happen actually. I had this guy who was a chiropractor, and he had a gangrenous toe, and he came to, you know, and he was actually trying to treat it with herbs. And it's like, dude, this is, you know, this is dead tissue. Okay. It doesn't, herbs are just not going to do it for you. And so this is one of those situations where you really actually have to amputate. Fortunately, it's a place that they can get to, and this is treatable. And unfortunately, it's probably going to end up costing you a fair amount of money. But at this point, I think your Medicare kicks in because now you've got osteomyelitis. And so
I've talked to the implant dentist in Sunnyvale that did the tooth, and they said that they would talk to their insurer. I said I'm in huge pain, not huge pain, but it's irritating.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I can't continue to live with this, and they would just give me another bottle of antibiotics.
Yeah, well, I know, and I understand that you're upset, okay? But you know, I think this isn't really a venue for ventilating frustration beyond just, you know, telling your story. So I really want to urge you to go out and find a good endodontist, maybe go to an oral maxillofacial surgeon, get this looked at and get it treated. It is extremely important, and you don't want to just wait and throw antibiotics at this problem. That was, at this point, it's very clear that is not going to work. But I'm not faulting the original management. I think that nothing we do always works, and it sounds to me like you got a pretty straightforward extraction and it went wrong, not because they didn't do it right, but because of the way you were built, maybe an extra root. Anyway, something went wrong, not because they did it wrong, but because it just didn't work. And you've got a complication. You need to deal with it. That's what I have to say about it. I'm going to go now to Karen in Soquel. Hello, Karen.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I'm calling about blood pressure issues. I am on the fence. I've gone to the doctor a couple times, and everyone recommends high blood pressure medicine. And I was wondering what your take is, and if you've got some medicine. Number one, do I need to take them? And if so, can you recommend some blood pressure medicine?
The first thing I'm going to say is, you know, at the very beginning of my show, it says this should not substitute as a this isn't a substitute for professional consultation. That's why that's there, is because I don't know your clinical situation. I don't know your family history, all of the other factors that are involved here. So I can't give specific advice to you. So I'm going to give you kind of a general answer to your question, okay?
Great.
All right. So the first thing I do when I'm confronted with a person with hypertension, particularly borderline hypertension, is I put them on a sort of I put them on high-dose omega-3 fatty acids, which lowers blood pressure a little bit. I put them on potassium, which lowers blood pressure a little bit. I put them on magnesium, which lowers blood pressure a little bit. And I put them on L-arginine, which lowers blood pressure a little bit. And between those three, and I also get them to start walking 20 minutes a day, and that's part of the prescription, is you get some light exercise, you take the appropriate minerals, you take this amino acid, which gets converted to nitric oxide in your bloodstream, and you see what happens. Also deep breathing, doing some kind of regular slow breathing, usually to a metronome or using a trainer, an online trainer. You can download apps for this. There's a device called a Respirate that you can buy online. Respirate with two E's and no I. Anyway, this is the basic thing to start with. There are also herbs. There's other things. Mark Houston has a great interview with me in the archives. If you look for, if you look up Mark Houston, spelled like the town in Texas, you will find a really good interview for the around the natural management for hypertension. And I always try that. I try to get the person to lose a little weight, put them on some minerals, get them walking. A lot of the time, that's enough to get the blood pressure under control. Now, if someone walks into my office and their blood pressure is 200 over 100, yeah, they're going on drugs. And they're also getting all this other advice, and with the idea that, you know, if you do these things and lose some weight and start exercising, take the herbs and minerals, we might just be able to stop the blood pressure medication in a few months. And I have successfully done that at least six times with patients over the last 10 years, where we were able to, where we got control of the crisis with the drugs, which God bless those drugs. And then we were able, to wean the person off the drugs and manage it naturally. And then one of those patients, who's a long-term patient, after about 5 years, the natural stuff just wasn't hacking it anymore, and we ended up having to use a drug. If I do have to use a drug, most of the time my go-to drug is something called an ARB. I mentioned these earlier, angiotensin receptor blocker. I now have to remember not to give Bactrim to or Septra to my patients who I'm putting on one of those because of the hyperkalemia or high potassium issue I mentioned earlier. But anyway, I like those drugs. They have a low side effect profile. They're very effective. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for drugs that don't cause more trouble trying to fix something and creating, you know, fatigue or creating erectile dysfunction or creating this, that, and the other thing with our drug. And we want to try and leverage a healthier lifestyle to see if maybe just lifestyle modification alone can make the difference.
Okay, great. I will try those things. I did try Losartan potassium. I believe that's an ARB, correct?
That is an ARB, yes.
I had some side effects to that. Is there another one you might recommend, an ARB?
There are several. I'm really Kozar, Diovan. I'm actually primarily using Losartan, but the best one is Telisartan.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and the reason I like that one best is it's very, very long acting, and it seems to work very. It has some potential to raise nitric oxide as well in clinical
right.
trials. So, and I'm sorry, I'm not remembering the trade name for Telisartan.
That's okay. Okay, I can look it up. But thank you very much. I will try the minerals again. If that doesn't work, recommend one of those.
And are you overweight?
No, I'm very active. I am.
Good.
I'm very active and run and bike and all that.
All right, good. I just can't overemphasize the importance of an active lifestyle and a healthy body weight when we're talking about hypertension. So yeah, glad you're starting out with those.
Yeah, I have that taken care of, but I do have it in my family history. So I'm one of those who's very fit and trim, but I still have it in my family. So I'm struggling with trying not to take medicine, but if I need to.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And let's go to Susie in Pacific Grove. Hello, Susie, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dunn. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
I have two questions. One is about osteoporosis. My bone density in spine is -4. Do you recommend that I take these shots like Prolia and stuff like that, or can I do it by taking calcium, vitamin D, and exercise?
Susie, when you get to your computer, if you look in the archives, or you can call back and give an email to my call screener, and we'll send you a series of links about osteoporosis because we've covered that topic so much on the show. Brief answer. That being said, there's much more depth there if you go mine the archives. Brief answer. At a T-score of -4, you are at imminent risk of trouble, and you probably need to use very aggressive therapy. You don't necessarily have to use an injection, but that might be the right thing for you, and you should explore the various injections that are available. But also, be sure if it's a bisphosphonate that you have had your dental health looked to. That gentleman who had the infection in his tooth, people who use the bisphosphonates, particularly if they're given by injection, if they have a tooth issue and it hasn't been attended to before the injection, they can get into a really serious chronic infection of the jaw. Visit your dentist, get a Panorex, make sure that there's nothing brewing there before you go forward with the injections.
Okay, yes, I need an implant, dental implant.
Okay, you want to get that. You want to get that done. You want to get that done first.
Okay.
Alrighty.
All right. Thank you. And the other one is about my cholesterol. My LDL level is 124. Should I take statin?
For an LDL of 124 in a female, off the top, there are subtleties, but that isn't even indicated. So I'll just put it that way. If you look at the guidelines, you don't even meet the guidelines for doing that. So, no.
Okay.
Just on the basis of the information I have, I would not recommend a statin. It is not a panacea. And as I keep telling people, in women who have never had a heart attack, there's actually not a scrap of data that it extends life, period. So why are we doing this? Anyway, that's a rhetorical question. Have a good day, Susie.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. We have another caller, Samantha in Marina. Hello, Samantha. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. I am a big fan. I've been listening for almost 30 years to you off and on. And you were talking to the previous couple callers back about high blood pressure and magnesium. I have low blood pressure, and I was taking magnesium really regularly. I've backed off a little bit now, but I wonder if magnesium is something I shouldn't be taking since I have quite low blood pressure.
In general, magnesium will not give you hypotension unless it's given intravenously. And that is a side effect of intravenous magnesium sulfate, which we used to use in preeclampsia, and I think is still used in women when they're in labor and have elevated blood pressure and they're at risk for seizures. We give them magnesium. The situation in your case is I would probably have recommended backing off. You could check a red blood cell magnesium, and if it's low, on the low end of the normal scale, then I would say, you know, inch back up on the magnesium and just compare your blood pressure on and off of it. So go off of it for a week, check your blood pressure, go back on it, see if it drops, because it doesn't usually cause hypotension, but it can. And so,
well, my blood pressure isn't low enough that I actually actively check it, but I know it's low. I have to be careful when I do inversions that I come up gradually. And
may not be low blood pressure. That may just be a sluggish reflex, because there's a reflex tightening of the blood vessels when especially if you're doing inversion. And as we age, that reflex slows down. So I have plenty of people who have moderate, normal, or even slightly high blood pressure, but when they stand up, their blood pressure drops because of that slow reflex.
Well, when they measure it every time I go into the doctor's office, it's pretty low.
Okay. So, but I'm just saying, you know, there are two factors at work here.
I see. I mean, I mostly take the magnesium to prevent cramping because nasty cramps in my feet or calves.
Which is why I think you probably have a low red blood cell magnesium.
Okay. I'll add that to the list next time I get blood work.
Ask them to check that. And you don't want to know if it's normal or not. You want to know if it's on the low end of normal. Because if you're cramping and you've got low end of normal magnesium, then you do need to continue supplementing.
Got it. Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Love
Bye-bye.
Your show.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye-bye. I had this article that I want to take a moment to share with you that was published in the Public Library of Science, and I kind of came across it sideways, which is often fun, especially online with the online science. It's an article looking at plant DNA in the human bloodstream and mouse bloodstream, and it reveals something quite interesting, which is that after we eat, there are in fact intact plant genes floating around in our bloodstream, and the levels vary from individual to individual. This is effectively proof of the concepts that I was talking about a little earlier when we talked about IgE and IgG, and the idea that food antigens could pass across the gut, get into the bloodstream, and interact with the immune system. So this is just, you know, more proof that large macromolecules, in this case, entire gene sequences from plants, chloroplasts, in fact, such that the plant itself could be identified, are found in the bloodstream after a meal. And it turns out tomatoes are particularly good at getting into our bloodstream. There's that whole group of people who don't eat nightshade vegetables because they get joint pain when they do it. And so it raises the question, are they reacting to plant DNA or plant antigens via an IgG mechanism? Is that why their joints hurt and why certain people with rheumatoid arthritis simply can't eat the nightshades? I would argue that that may in fact be the mechanism. And if you look in the scientific literature for support of this new age kind of alternative, wacky food sensitivity, circulating food antigens, immune reaction stuff, you'll find the data. Interestingly, I recently did some IgG testing using the local laboratory, and all of the things I tested the patient for came back negative. And I'm really curious what the thresholds are for the lab, because it's now crossing my mind that where you put your normal and your abnormal, if it's based just on the general population and this problem is distributed in the general population, maybe normal isn't so healthy anymore. Let's go to a couple of last emails. This one from Bob in Seaside. 73-year-old friend recently diagnosed with tonsil cancer has begun chemo and radiation. He's told it's more common between 40 and 60 and often develops from the human papillomavirus. This is all true, Bob. What got my attention was that his Monterey MD said that this is an epidemic, and they see, and this is probably a ear, nose, and throat doctor, two cases a week of head and neck cancer or tonsil cancer or the doctor also meant tongue cancer and squamous cell of the mouth in general. And this is an absolute fact. We are looking at tenfold increase in the last decade in mouth squamous cell carcinomas, tongue, gum, tonsil, roof of the mouth. And all of these, most of these cancers, when they are looked at genetically, show evidence of incorporation in the cancer cells of human papillomavirus. So in other words, genital warts cause oral cancer. I think we can all imagine the vector, how that works. A person is exposed to genital warts through oral sex, and the oral sex 10, 15, 30 years later comes back to haunt you, much in the way that cervical cancer is a result of exposure to the human papillomavirus. Giving the vaccine for human papillomavirus to men as well as women, particularly young men before they become sexually active, should be a public health priority in our society because of this very fact. We have a treatment that will stem this epidemic and turn it around. So parents, think about vaccinating your boy children, because this human papillomavirus is out there, and as we reduce it in the population, getting both the males and the females resistant to it through vaccination, we will eliminate a future possibility, particularly in the case of these oral cancers, very disfiguring, awful, painful, difficult disease to treat, and you can avoid it. We had one last quick email, this from Tom in Gilroy, and Tom's wife has had C. difficile. There was something on the news this morning talking about C. difficile, I believe, and basically what this is it's an infection you get after you've received high doses of antibiotics. It's an opportunistic infection. The probiotic that she should be using is Saccharomyces boulardii, and there is good data that that will prevent recurrence, S. boulardii, and I generally will use probiotics from a company called Claire, K-L-A-I-R-E. I do not receive any funding from them, so I feel like I can say that this is a company I trust. Hope you find that helpful, Tom. We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you found it helpful. This is Dr. Don saying join me next week, and until then, so long and stay healthy.